broadcasting worldwide via the internet from Lakeland, Florida. This is Whitfield Radio's True Believer program. And now, here is your host, the founder and president of Whitfield Theological Seminary and senior pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church in Lakeland, Florida, Dr. Kenneth G. Talbot.
Welcome to our show, and thank you for your prayers and support of this ministry. Today we have on our show Mr. Jason Bradfield, web director of WhitfieldMedia.com. My co-host is Dr. Bill Sullivan. Welcome, Dr. Bill, to what I hope is another invigorating show.
Now, this one's going to be very interesting from what I understand. I'm going to learn a lot during this program, so I'll be listening and I'll be asking questions when you talk about something that I didn't quite get.
Now, there's going to be some areas that I'm not too sure of either, but we'll look forward to getting some answers and being able to dialogue on areas of music that I'm not just familiar with. Listen, we have some important news. Mr. Joel McDermott will be debating with Dr. Don Preston on the issues related to hyperpreterism. This debate will take place on July 19th through the 21st at Ardmore, Oklahoma. Don Preston is a former Church of Christ minister whose soteriology is semi-Pelagianistic. And Joel McDermott will be representing a reformed soteriology and thus purporting to a partial preterist postmillennial eschatology. Perhaps we can get Joel on in a future show, be able to talk to him about his new book, Jesus versus Jerusalem, and about the upcoming debate and what we can expect if we attend, or possibly it might even be broadcast. Today's show is entitled From Orthodoxy to Orthodoxy, The Journey to and from Hyperpreterism. As I said, our guest is Mr. Jason Bradfield. Jason briefly attended New Orleans Theological Seminary and is now enrolled in Whitfield Theological Seminary as a student in the Master of Divinity degree program. Jason embraced Christ his senior year of high school in 1993. Served 2 years as a youth minister in Anniston, Alabama, and Houma, Louisiana, with the Southern Baptist denomination. During a stretch of around 3 years, he took the good news of the kingship of Christ to some of the most poverty-stricken areas of Anniston and Birmingham, Alabama, as well as in New Orleans, in the form, Mr. Bill, hip-hop. Hip-hop music.
Hip-hop? Well, I don't know what that is.
Oh, I've heard it, but I still don't know what it is. He embraced full preterism in 2003 and then renounced it in 2010. He serves as web director of Reign of Christ Ministries, as well as I have noted with WhitfieldMedia.com. Jason will also be joining Samuel Frost, Dr. Bill, and I on our new radio show that is soon to be launched, Last Days Madness. Jason is currently, as I said, enrolled with Whitfield Seminary. He resides in East Tennessee with his wife, Amanda, and children, Jordan, Alexis, Kaylee, and Anna. Jason, it is good to have you as a guest on True Believer here at Whitfield Radio, and I would like to express my gratitude for the work that you are doing on the WhitfieldMedia.com site.
Well, thank you, Dr. Talbot and Dr. Sullivan. It's a blessing to be here, and I appreciate you guys having me.
Well, Jason, let me talk to you just before we get into your journey on theological and eschatological issues in the area of hyperpreterism. Let's talk, though, for just a few moments about your interest in Christian hip-hop music, if you don't mind. First, if you could, explain for at least some of us who do not know exactly what hip-hop is, if you would, what is hip-hop music?
Huge question. Well, obviously, it got started about the time that I was born there in the 70s. And so I came in it a little later. But from what I've heard, I actually got to meet Curtis Blow, who's considered like one of the grandfathers of hip hop. I think he had one of the first commercial hits out. He's actually now a Christian. And so I got to meet him down in Florida. And he shared a little bit with us about its history. Some of it came out of New York. And, of course, there's a big debate on where exactly in New York it comes from, because you have certain neighborhoods that claim it came from there. And the guys across the bridge are like, no, it came from here. But essentially what it was, the way he explained it, was back in those days, you know, it was popular for the well-to-do people to go off to the clubs every weekend and go to the discos and all this. And so
right,
the more impoverished areas, the people couldn't afford to go to these clubs, they would actually do like little block parties in the streets. And a lot of it was, I think a lot of it came out of the disco movement, but at some point, these people that were basically doing the music, the DJs, it was very common for them to dance during the breaks of certain songs, and so the DJs would actually spin the records back and just loop a break over and over again, and these people became known as break dancers. And then over time, MCs started to step up on the stage, and they would usually voice their problems that they were having with the state or with the government. I mean, it was basically just a stage to voice the oppression that they felt like they were under, and to the music. And but anyway, it basically started as just a big block party, like I said, for the poor people, impoverished areas. And
Would it be right to say that hip hop eventually gave birth into rap?
Yeah, now hip hop, that actual phrase describes a subculture, and then within that, there's usually four things that they associate with hip hop. There's the rapping or the emceeing, the DJing, the dancing or the breakdancing, and then the graffiti writing. Curtis was telling us as far as how the graffiti came about. Some of the apartments that they lived in, I forget when there was a big fire in New York. I can't remember when it was. Engulfed a great deal of the city where these people lived, and because of, I think it was an insurance scam, and these people had nowhere to go, so they're basically stuck living in these buildings that are half burnt down. And so they would actually take paint and mark their rooms because there was no way to tell, you know, whose apartment was what because of all the damage that was done through the fires. And so they would actually take spray paint and mark their building like, this is my house, keep out.
Right.
And so that kind of developed into this graffiti writing and just kind of became an art. But yeah, hip-hop is just referring to that whole subculture. And then rapping is just a part of it.
So the subculture itself, historically, then, would be within the black community, most likely.
Yeah, within particularly the Bronx area of New York.
Right.
I don't think it was solely just the blacks, but...
It certainly caught on quickly and spread.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, how did hip-hop come into the Christian music scene? And who were those early influences from a Christian perspective?
Well, I started following Christ in 93, having grew up listening to rap, and at that time in 93, there wasn't a whole lot out, at least in the bookstores. And I was in Alabama at this time, and to walk into a bookstore in Alabama and ask for Christian hip-hop, they just looked at you like you were like, what are you talking about? We don't have a clue. Now, I'm sure, like, you know, in the areas of New York and stuff like that, it was probably more well-known, but it just wasn't out in the mainstream like it is now. So when I first came into it, I came in it just through whatever was available through the bookstores. And at that time, there's only so many people out, and a lot of it I actually didn't like. It was kind of behind the time, kind of corny. You know, one of the groups, for example, was DC Talk. And when I first listened to them, I just kind of shook my head. It's like, it's just not the kind of style that I'm used to. It was just more of a flaky sound, and lyrics were really simple, nothing complex. And but, you know, DC Talk was, I guess, big in churches like I was, you know, in Alabama and areas like that. I eventually got a job at a Christian bookstore, and I was actually in charge of managing the music section. And through there, I was able to get into a database through a warehouse and actually started finding some of this hip hop that I didn't hear about, that was available through the other bookstores. And, but some of the early, I'm kind of trying to think of some of the names now. I was having a mind's going blank here, but like there was a guy named T-Bone.
Okay.
You know, he was pretty popular at that time in 93. And then later on there's a group called from Nashville called the Grits, and then the Cross Movement came out, and with Cross Movement they finally started hearing some music that I was more in tune with, more of my style. But it pretty much, in fact, the whole reason I actually got into hip hop is because it just wasn't that popular, and nobody really knew anything about it, and what was available I didn't really care for. And so I actually kind of went into it myself just as sort of a dare from a youth minister. He was like, well, if there's nothing available, why don't you write yourself and do your own thing?
Hey, now, Jason, you mentioned four things that make up hip-hop. Now, how would those be reflected in Christian type of an approach?
They pretty much all exist within Christian circles.
Would this be kind of a part of the postmodern movement that we find in Christianity?
Yeah,
like the emergent question. The emergent church movement and that kind of thing, where it's more coffee shop and music, along with the concept of not preaching and not a formal church, but dialogue and gathering together to interact and music to go along with that?
Yeah, there's definitely some of that going on. I know early on, like T-Bone, for example, I think he was in the charismatic Pentecostal circles, and it seemed to be pretty heavy among those circles early on. But I don't know that it's all postmodern. Some of it's just... I got into it and started doing it. I just seen the power to take a rap song and just fill it with content and lyrics. And I mean, I would literally preach in a song. And so for me, it was just a way to, I could take that into a street area, and it was just a tool for me to kind of attract the fish, you know, to come out.
In other words, you were coming into their cultural environment, but you were bringing the same music, just with different words.
Right. And that's essentially all that we're really doing. Music-wise, beat-wise, it's gotten to the point now where, you know, there's some pretty good producers out there, and you're going to hear some very professional stuff, but it's all about the lyrics. You know, what exactly are you saying in your lyrics? And, of course, a lot of the worldly hip-hop music is glorifying violence and drugs and sex and all that. And so essentially what we're doing is we're just taking it. And, some people do a little bit more like a positive type message.
Right.
And then you have some artists that are actually very aggressive. And well, there's a group, they're coming out with a new album here at the 1st of November called Christ-Centric, who's one of my favorite groups. And in their album, it's a concept album. Basically what they're doing is they're taking you through the book of Ephesians, where they're actually expositing some of the key themes of Ephesians. So within Christian hip-hop, you have a wide range, and there's even a lot of debate among the artists as to how preachy we should be, or you know, who exactly is our audience? Are we rapping for the church, or are we rapping to evangelize? And you know, some people see it as a totally as an evangelistic tool, and then some people see it as a way to edify the church, and then some guys do a little bit of both. So a wide range.
What kind of response did you get, generally speaking?
Well, when I did my thing, of course, I was real corny when I first started doing it. I mean, my lyric was like, 1, 2, 3, yes, it's me, the Bonafide, thanks, you know, kind of like that. And but I was in Alabama, so they thought it was neat. They thought it was cool.
It needed a southern twang to it.
Yeah, I mean, if I had tried to pull that off, like, in New York, they probably would have laughed me out of the building, but... there in Alabama, they liked it, and next thing I know, the kids are kind of, they're telling their friends about me performing, and I just started getting invited like crazy to different churches, to schools. I've done prayer breakfasts for football teams and see at the pole rallies and lock-ins and all kinds of stuff, so it just kind of grew, and, you know, over time, I kind of developed my skills in writing, you know, trying to be a little bit more complex, because again, there's a wide range within rap. You have some people that have very simple lyrics and almost too simple, kind of dumbed down. Sounds idiotic. Most of the stuff on the radio, I think, is idiotic. But and then you have certain guys within the movement that are basically writing poetry. In fact, some of the artists have actually been in college and have studied poetry and literary structure and stuff, and get really creative with their lyrics. And that's the type of the style that I tend to.
Where do you get the music from to put this with your writing and in the lyrics and stuff you're doing?
Well, with me, I'm just borrowing tracks from artists that already exist. You know, one of the things that's popular within hip-hop is when people put out an album, they'll provide, like, an instrumental so their fans can actually take an instrumental and write with it. You know, one of the things that a lot of people do, they call it remix tapes or remix albums, where artists will actually take music from other artists and just write their lyrics on top of it and actually put that out as a full album. So it's a common thing to do. I've never had the resources or the ability to do my own music, so I basically just took a lot of the music that I had growing up, a lot of the instrumentals, and just started writing lyrics over the top of them, and just perform them.
I wondered if in your studies with Whitfield Theological Seminary, are you going to turn in your assignments in Christian hip-hop?
Yeah, it would be nice to.
Well, I took a course from Covenant Seminary some years ago, and Dr. David Calhoun was the teacher, and he told a story about a fellow who turned in a paper on Christian history in rap form, and he said it was really good. The guy got an A, so...
Yeah, there's actually, I think I've seen a video where a professor, I think it was Southern, the Southern Baptist school there, the flagship school in Kentucky, one of the professors actually did a rap in a class, just having fun with it. But
well, listen, you've got one of your songs for us you're going to perform. Tell us just a little bit about the song you wrote and what it's about, and then we'll give it a listen.
Yeah, this is not a full-blown song. This is just a lyric that I wrote. Like I said, I tend to gravitate more towards the quote-unquote preachy end of hip-hop, and so I love to use the music to get people's attention with certain doctrines and things, and so this lyric here is basically a paraphrase from a chapter in John Owen's book, The Death of Death and the Death of Christ. And it's basically going through his logical argument on limited atonement.
Let's listen to the song by Jason Bradfield.
And I think we're dead. Time is going by really, 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 really slow. All right, yo, I got a simple question for you theologians out there. For whom did Christ suffer? For whom did he die? And how did he die? Did he just die to give the possibility of salvation, thinking, well, I hope they take advantage of it? Or did he actually die in my place? Yeah. The Father imposed his wrath through and through, and the Son chose blood flow from the nose for who? Some of the sins of all men, all the sins of some men, all the sins of all men, no stalling. Let's begin with the first verse. Weep if that's the scenario, cause all the reap in the crib by getting cursed at the burial. But peep the second option. The Christ suffered to cover all the sins of those who be elected for adoption. That makes sense. Hands of the servant in case we'd have to face the absurd of an effectual grace. But wait, y'all said he stalled in the grief because of unbelief, but don't that fall under the all that Christ believes? If it's not, then Christ didn't die for all sin. And if for none of all men with salvation be rotten, to stop and think for a minute, to thank God for the second that you have been deservedly selected. Check it.
All right, Jason. Well, you know, you set the song to me. The good part was you put words that I could read to it. So it really helps me out. I'm just an old guy now, so you can call me an old fogey if you'd like.
Hey, Jason, has anyone else done a song taking Puritan works like that you know of?
Yeah, I wrote that in 03, and, you know, I don't recall. I'm trying to think of when Lamp Mode come out. There's a group up in Philadelphia called Lamp Mode, and there's a couple of guys within that label. They have a reform background. There's another guy, he's actually a good friend of mine, Rick Roldan, who we're hoping is going to co-host the show with me. He's got a long reform background, and he's actually done some songs from that perspective. He did a song on Tulip, and I think I can't remember the name of it now, but I think it's named after a book from R.C. Sproul. So yeah, there's a couple artists out there that are doing a little bit of that. There's a guy named The Voice who I think actually did a song on the Heidelberg Catechism, and I think D.A. Carson even did a little a little hook or something he was involved in just for fun.
Oh, in that particular production, you mean?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, that would be worth getting and listening to. Well, I know we have students here from the University of Florida who also, and they use this as a means to spread the gospel in the Reformed perspective among black students. They have a real wonderful opportunity of getting and working within their own community, and it has been a real successful thing. It's been both encouraging to those that have listened to it, and it's been challenging to those who have never heard the Reformed perspective of the gospel. So it's very important that we reach out into these cultures and try to reach the people where they are to bring them to the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so that's very, very important. Well, listen, we thank you for talking with us about that part, but let's move on now to our topic that really is going to take up most of our time. If you would, Jason, tell me just a little bit about your background, your early childhood, and then eventually what led to your conversion in Christ in 1993.
Well, I was a bicentennial baby, born in Colorado Springs, where my dad was stationed there in the Army. So I was an Army brat and lived all over the country, and we even lived 3 years in Germany. But we were basically an agnostic home. My dad had some experience in his childhood with church, but he had gotten away from it when he joined the military. My mom, I don't think, had any experience with the church. So we just, you know, my dad being in the military and at least having some sort of experience, you know, we just tried to be good law-abiding citizens and didn't do anything crazy. And I was basically under the impression that you know, if there is a God, then, and if he does decide to judge me, then I should be all right, because I haven't killed anybody or robbed any banks. And I never did go the evolution hardcore atheist route, though. It just never did make sense to me. But what finally happened in 2 months into my senior year of high school, which would have been 93, end of 93, this girl from church, or this girl from school, asked me to go to church with her. And I kind of had a crush on her. I don't know that I would have agreed to it if some guy had asked me to go, but since she asked me, I was like, yeah, I'll go hang out with you for a day on a date. I mean, go to church. So I went to church that Sunday, and turns out that particular Sunday was a thing that this Southern Baptist church does every year. It's called Friend Day. And basically it was a setup. And what they did was every year on this particular day, they would urge their members to bring as many lost people as they can. And the whole service was geared around evangelism.
Right.
So I go to this service, and I hear basically like a 45-minute presentation on just a general gospel message about, you know, how we were created and what happened after we were created and how God fixed the problem through Jesus Christ, and, you know, that I was a sinner and broken God's law, and, you know, that I couldn't earn God's favor through my own works and my own righteousness, so-called. And it was really the first time that I had heard all that explained to me. And even to my own surprise, I was just sat there finding myself believing it, believing every word of it. So right there, as I'm listening to this, I'm, repenting and crying out to Christ, you know, and acknowledging his lordship and seeking forgiveness and understanding again that there's nothing that I can do. It's totally on the work of Christ. And so at the end of the service, they did a altar call. This is a, you know, semi-Pelagian dispensational Southern Baptist church. But so yeah, I went ahead and went down and said the little sinner's prayer. But, you know, what's weird was even then I knew that was a little weird, because when I went down there and said, would you like to pray and receive Christ, quote unquote? And I thought, well, I've already repented in my back, you know, in the pew. All right, but if you want me to say this prayer, I'll say it, whatever. So I was baptized a week later in that church, and I naturally joined that church. I mean, because I didn't have any background, I didn't know what a Baptist was, or Southern Baptist, or Presbyterian. I didn't know any of that stuff. So
right.
it was just natural for me to hook up with this group. And then I told my parents about midweek that I was doing this, and I was a little slow in telling them because I wasn't sure how they were going to respond, but they actually were very positive about it. And then they came to my baptism that Sunday, and then the very next day, Monday, the church sent out an evangelism team to my house and sat down with my mom, my dad, and my brother. I have one sibling, he's 3 years younger than me, Jeff, and basically sharing the gospel with them, and all three of them repent and confess Christ. And
well, wonderful.
Been faithful ever since. So it's
kind of
a household thing.
Praise the Lord.
Yeah.
Okay, after your conversion then, did you stay with this church?
Yeah, I stayed with them, I think, till about 97.
Okay. You identified their theology as being Arminian, and what was their eschatology? Was it, you said dispensational. I'm assuming it's a premillennial dispensational type.
Oh, yeah.
Teaching
very hardcore. Jesus is coming back any moment. In fact, I mean, they pushed it so hard that there was no form of discipleship whatsoever, because they really didn't. I don't think they wouldn't have came out and said, well, there's no need for discipleship. But practically, that's how it was. It was like, let's just get as many people saved as we can, because we're at the end. And that's how I live my life. I didn't know to question that, because I didn't know anything, and so I naturally just believed that, and I took the pastor's word for it. And it came to create problems for me. After I graduated, I got a full basketball scholarship at Gadsden State there in Alabama. And I left after the first year, and part of that was I just really struggled with the idea of me playing basketball. I mean, if Jesus is going to come back at any moment, do I really want to be playing basketball when he comes back?
Right, you know? Right.
You know, shouldn't I be out there in the mission field saving people from this great tribulation that's fixing to hit the whole world? And so I actually gave up basketball, and that was that dispensational rapture-ready mindset was a big part of that.
I was raised in that very safe type of church most of my life, up until the time I turned Reformed when I was 19 years old, 20 years old, going to college. But, you know, one of the things that I always seen is eschatology was also kind of used as a means of trying to keep you in line ethically. Jesus is coming back, therefore he's going to judge, and he knows what you're doing, and you better be ready. And it wasn't that I wanted to live for Christ who saved me, and that he was a holy God, and therefore I was to be holy like him, and there was a love that was to drive me, but the eschatology was used very strongly to say you gotta stay in line here, because you know their views were very legalistic, and so for them eschatology was also a means of not only talking about the immediacy of things, and what do you want Jesus to see what you're doing when he comes back, and would he really appreciate what you're doing? Would he see value in that? Rather than a Reformed answer and response would have been, as if I'm doing it to the glory of God, of course he would have. He wouldn't, no matter what part of life I'm working in. But for them, it wasn't. It was that concept of you have to be doing something that they would say, quote-unquote, would be spiritual. You need to be out winning people to Christ, or doing bus work, or you need to be doing junior church ministry, or preaching, visitation ministry. If you're doing those kind of things, those were the spiritual things. Mowing the yard, washing the dishes, having a vocational job, that was secular. And it was actually a truly more of a Roman Catholic, Thomistic dialectic. There was these two areas, and one area is spiritual and one is not. And the way to keep you into that spiritual realm was to drive you with this immediate expectation of Christ. Did you feel that also as a part of the church's teaching in your life and how it was affecting you, is the way you're kind of talking about now?
Yeah, well, you described it perfectly. I mean, that was, there was just, you know, there was just this constant conflict in my mind, struggle of, like you said, you know, is this really spiritual that I'm playing basketball yeah, I mean, I can't really describe it as good as you did.
Yeah, you can't play basketball and be a Christian, because it's just not what Jesus would have you to do. I'll give you an example. When I was in my senior year, we had a very good youth pastor. We lost him, and we had another guy come in, and he was very good, very nice. One of the things he said is, as Christians, you ought not be going to the prom. We'll have a prom. Well, it'll be a Christian prom. We'll have it at church. So most of our kids, me included, said, okay, well, this is spiritual, you know, this is, and we missed the prom, and doesn't he get hired off about 3 weeks after our prom, when he was supposed to be setting up for one to have that's Christian, and he's gone. He just transferred and never gave a second thought to what he had us remove ourselves from. Going to the prom that we were graduating in the class our senior year with the people that we've known, a time to be able to be together, have fun. And you know, that was just unchristian, to be among lost people, to have non-Christian music playing. Therefore, you must go out and do something different, and we need to do it Christian, and yet no follow through. And I've seen it from a perspective that it was just one of those other tricks. You know, Christ is coming. You know, would you want to be at prom when it happened?
Don't you almost also, you have a tremendous sense of guilt if you're not constantly
it is guilt manipulated
and trying to get people saved and that type of thing.
It is largely hooked on guilt manipulation. And I think Jason's expressing that very thing. Well, listen, Jason, we know that you, at some point, move along to Reformed theology. Would you talk a little bit just about how you got involved in the study of Reformed theology?
Well, through the hip-hop thing, as I'm going to the inner cities and kind of baiting these people to come out, and I'd rap to them and I'd share the gospel with them, over time, I actually would get some responses from people, one of the things that I struggled with was, all right, I've gotten some teenagers to respond, now what do I do with them? And some of them, it was hard for me to do anything with because they would be in a city like, 30 miles from where I lived, or sometimes it was even in another state. And so I got in the habit of, when I'd go and perform, of letting some of the local churches in the area where I was performing, let them know that I was coming and, hey, I might get responses and I would like for you guys to step up and follow through with these people. And I could not for the life of me, especially in the inner city, get churches to do this. There's just like, and I don't know if it was, kind of the whole prophet is without honor in his home country, like, oh yeah, that's great that Steve responded to you and your message, but we've dealt with him before and we don't want nothing to do with him, but over time I kind of developed this desire to actually get into discipleship with people and not just hit an area and rap and get people to respond and then leave. But I was trying to figure out some way that I can actually plug the people that have responded into some type of discipleship. And so that's where I kind of got interested in youth ministry. So in 97, I actually took a part-time youth minister job at a small Baptist church in Anniston. It was like right on the edge of the inner city. And I thought it was a great place to kind of operate as headquarters. And as I go out and perform and do my thing, then I'd have a place where I can actually invite people that have responded to come and sit under some teaching and stuff. And so I did that for about a year, and my youth group only grew to like 8 or 9 people or kids. But after doing it for a year, I finally realized that I really didn't have any business being in that position because I was still immature myself in the faith. There's a lot of things I didn't know. And add to that the fact that I had youth that were, I think all but one youth came from a broken home. Some of the youth had been involved in drugs, and they're like 12, 13 years old. One of the girls had been sexually molested by a family member, and I was just lost. I didn't know, how to counsel these kids and what to do with them. So I finally told Amanda, who I was dating at this time, like, I got to get some training somehow. So in March of 98, we got married, and 2 weeks later moved to New Orleans.
Was that with the intent of going to New Orleans Theological Seminary?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was just a school that was recommended, and I think it was one of the closer ones to where we were at there in Alabama. And so I just went, and ideally they would have liked for us to wait until the fall to move down there, but we moved in March, and so I had the whole summer. They asked me just to take one class during the summer, and then we got to live on campus and all that. And during that summer, I knew that since I was going into the classroom and would be discussing deep theological stuff, that I was just reading my Bible like crazy from cover to cover.
Right.
I must have read it 5 or 6 times just in those summer months. And about my third trip reading through the scriptures, I just started noticing some things that, I'd read it and I'm like, did he just say what I thought he said? And like texts like Romans 9 and,
right.
There's one in 2 Chronicles where it says that the Lord gave the people the heart to do what the king had obeyed. And that's like, he gave them the heart. So what if he hadn't given them the heart? Would they still obey the king? And And so I just had these questions, and I didn't know anything about Calvinism or Reformed theology. I didn't even know who Charles Spurgeon was. This was just stuff that was coming out of the text, and you know, I'd see the word election and predestined, and I'm like, what do these words mean? So,
where did they come from? Why are they in my Bible now?
Yeah.
First time you see them, but from that perspective, it's like, wait a minute, I've never seen this word before. I've never heard a preacher preach on this before.
Yeah, never heard it preached about, never. I don't think my pastor, my home pastor, even preached against it. I just never heard anything about it. Didn't know that there was alternative understandings out there within Christianity. So I basically, through those months, pretty much studied my way into Calvinism, you know, or what we call the 5 points, or not knowing that that's what it was called. In fact, I remember bringing it up to a guy on campus there. I would play basketball every week, and I said, hey, what do you do with this Romans 9 and this? And he said, well, you sound like a Calvinist. And I said, what? And I kid you not, the name that actually popped up in my head when he said that was Calvin Klein. That's the only thing I could think of. I just didn't have a clue what he was talking about. So I actually prayed, but now I had a label. I had something I could work with, so I actually started praying to the Lord to lead me to these people that are Calvinists. I don't know who they are. I don't know if they're even still alive. Just, Lord, you know, lead me to them.
Wait, was this all in just from reading the Bible?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, you weren't reading anything else particularly?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually went to the bookstore, and I was just scanning the shelves. I was, like, looking for something, Calvinism. You know, or some of the keywords like election.
Right.
And I don't remember what got my attention, but I was in the evangelism section. I saw a book by John Piper called Let the Nations Be Glad. And I don't even remember exactly what was on that cover, the back cover that made me pick it up. But I picked it up and I started flipping through it. And there's one section there where Piper, you know, he talks about how missions exist because worship doesn't. And there's a part where he kind of does a survey of the Bible, and he asks the question, why does God do what he does? Mm. And he does like a question and answer thing, and there's like 30 of these questions. And every answer, he'll quote a scripture and say, you know, why did God create the world? For his glory. You know, why did God call out Israel? For his namesake. You know, why does God save us? For his glory. And so you see this golden thread throughout the scriptures of God doing things for his glory, for his namesake. And when I was reading that, I was like, okay, this sounds like what I'm getting into. There's a connection here I'm making with this book. And so I bought it and took it home, and I found out more about John Piper, and it was through Desiring God, John, you know, his ministry. But
right.
That was basically my gateway into the Reformed world, because through Piper I started hearing about Jonathan Edwards and Calvin and Spurgeon and Luther and all these guys. And So he was kind of my gateway into all that.
Yeah, excellent. What were some of the early books you wrote, bought besides Piper?
I bought a few. There's a book that Piper edited, but it was a John Owen work. Was it The End for Which the World Was Created?
That sounds
correct. And then I had bought quite a bit of Spurgeon. And I bought some, you know, some of the bookstores, they used to sell these real cheap paperbacks of Spurgeon. Most of it was just collection of sermons and things
right.
like that. But I've gotten hooked into Spurgeon pretty early on. And then I think even John MacArthur, which, you know, he's not Reformed. I wouldn't call him Reformed, but
he is Calvinistic.
You know, he's got a little bit there going on.
Right.
Certainly a lot better than what I was, that I started off with. So I started reading some of him, and yeah, those were some of the early. But Spurgeon was a big
influence.
Yeah.
Yeah. You also took an interest in the writings of Dr. Gordon Clark. What caused you to become a student of Dr. Clark's writings?
Well, this actually would have been after I embraced full preterism. But through full preterism, I became good friends with Sam Prost, who you guys have had on the show. And Sam's email used to be, I think it was gclark something something at Yahoo. And I finally just asked him one day, I was like, what is this gclark email thing? I mean, why is your email not Sam Prost? So he told me, he's like, oh, if you're excited, you know, you get all excited about theology and preterism, wait till you read this guy. And I think we were sitting in Bennigan's there in Brandon when he was telling me about him. And he just started telling me about some of Clark and some of the stuff he emphasized. And I just instantly was hooked and interested. And so it was through Sam that I started buying some books online of his. And I think the first year or two, I must have read, I don't know, about 20 of his books. And it took a while to, especially early on, a lot of it I just didn't understand quite what he was doing, especially when he had asked questions like, you know, what is a tree? Do we even know what a tree is? And I'm like, what do you mean, what is a tree? And I didn't understand that there was a deeper thing he was addressing there with empiricism and, you know, how do we come to know anything at all? This, you know, is data actually imparted to our minds through the experience of the sight and the senses and the sound? And
exactly.
I didn't know that that's what he was addressing at first, but after about a year of reading him, some of that just finally started to click. It makes sense to me, but
yeah, absolutely. Well, let's just take a step back. When did you start to seriously consider eschatology? You said your study of Clark came later with Sam, but let's step back. You're starting to move into questions about eschatology. Where did that take place, and at what point in time did that begin to interact possibly with Sam Frost or others?
Yeah, well, like I said, by default, I was dispensational, not really a studied dispensationalist. It's just what I latched on to early. And what really started to challenge that for me was in 2001 with the 9/11 attacks. We're in Alabama and I'm managing some apartments and this guy was coming to pay his rent. Obviously he was late, but he came to me and, he said, Jason, this is it. He said, I think Jesus is going to be back within a week's time. And because I had already gone through
I won't pay you. Yeah. Is that his answer? I'm going to keep my rent.
So because I had already been through one transition where I understood that there was, you know, alternative way of understanding salvation and predestination, I was learning by that time to think more critically about things. And,
right.
And so I was sitting there listening to him. I was like, you know, that just doesn't make any sense to me. I said, I've read the Bible a number of times by now, and it never occurred to me that the attacks in New York would somehow be linked to the end of the world and Jesus coming back. So, and then the other thing that bothered me was I was a big subscriber to the Voice of the Martyrs newsletter, which I had learned through Piper. And another question that I thought was, well, what is so important about our country that if we get attacked, then that's it. You know, God's done and he's ready to wrap this up. And
exactly.
To me, it seemed kind of arrogant because you've got terrorism going on all over the world and Christians being martyred and, you know, burned. And so why do we not see those things as a sign of the end and Jesus is coming back next week? What's so special about us? And so those were just some of the questions that I started asking myself. And I knew what he was saying was wrong, but I didn't really know what the right answer was. You know, it'd be like me asking you, you know, what is 6.782 million times 182,482?
276,548.
You know, if I said, is it four? You'd be like, no, it's definitely not four. It's more than that. So you know it's the wrong answer, but you're not sure what the right answer is. Let me get back to you on that. And that's where I was at with this. And so I started started reading, just going back to the scriptures, and kind of in a similar vein with the Calvinism, just through my own reading, I started leaning more towards like a post-millennial, loosely a post-millennial preterist view. Like I could not help but see, especially in Daniel, that there was something big that was supposed to happen during the time of that fourth kingdom, and then when, by the time you get to the Gospels, it hits the ground and running. You know, Jesus immediately, the kingdom of God is at hand, and repent, and you have this strong imminency thing going on. And
so, Jason, for clarification, preterist postmillennialism, just comment briefly on what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, basically, I say loose postmill because I was seeing a strong, like, preterist element. Like, I believe that there was something that was fulfilled in the first century. And believe it or not, you might laugh at this, I didn't even know that the temple had been destroyed in AD 70. And yet I couldn't help but, you know, read Matthew 24 and some of these texts and think that, you know, whatever it is these people are talking about, it was something that was going to happen within their lifetime. There's certain things. And
right.
And because a lot of that I had understood as being fulfilled, you know, one of the reasons why I don't think I got too interested in amillennialism, because every version of amillennialism that I had heard from my friends still interpreted like the Great Tribulation, a lot of these things is still future. And so since I had that in the past, I just kind of naturally was bent towards a post-millennial type of thinking. But
so you were seeing things already fulfilled that before you were being taught were yet in the future.
Right.
Okay, so you're seeing Christ returning after these things happen. And they've already happened.
Right. And, you know, a big question for me again was like the rapture. You know, where is that taught in the scriptures? Where is it taught in Matthew 24? And I'd go back and read MacArthur. And, you know, MacArthur would make arguments of silence from like the book of Revelation. You know, he'd say, well, the church is not mentioned in chapters 4 through 11 or whatever. And so the church must be gone. And I was like, I don't buy that. You know, and I had a hard time, you know, seeing where the rapture thing was taught. And so I was leaning in this direction of a preterism, post-mill, and then
did you know what it was called at the time?
No.
Didn't. Okay. You hadn't read anything on preterism or post-millennialism.
Right. And I went to at church. I had a friend that actually came from the same home church that I did and had become a Calvinist. And so I was asking him, I was like, where are you at on this issue of rapture and series you'd be really interested in? And it was an eschatology conference from Ligonier. I don't remember the year. Was that 93 or something when that was done, that big eschatology conference?
I don't know the date. Ligonier, I just know they had one.
Yeah. But he gave me this tape out, album set, and when I opened it up, one of the first tapes I saw was this tape by some guy named Kenneth Gentry, and it was on Matthew 24, and the name of the tape was something like Past or Future or something like that, and I was like, oh, wow, this looks interesting. So I immediately popped in that cassette, and that was actually the first time I had ever heard that the temple was destroyed in AD 70. So in okay. When I heard that, I was like, oh, wow, this might actually work, you know, historically, something actually did happen. And so some of the pieces started falling. And so just as Piper was my gateway into Calvinism, Gentry was my gateway into post-millennial thought. And
post-millennialism, yeah.
It was through him that I started learning all these different names. And at one point, I actually drove over to Atlanta because I was only like an hour and a half away, and actually got to meet Gary DeMar and his assistant at the time. I think it was Ralph Barker.
Correct.
And I bought like $800 worth of books from him that day. I was just, there was just something about Gentry that just immediately, because of my experience with dispensational and just people not wanting the discipleship and all this, you know, thinking long term, that there was something about the post-millennial world that just immediately attracted me. Like, this is a full orbed worldview that just seems so rich to me. And that's why I just, when I went to DeMar, I just said, give me everything you got. And I started reading Chilton and DeMar and North and a little bit of Rush Denny. And so that's kind of how I found out that I was leaning in that direction of postmillennialism.
What time frame are we in now? Is this after 9/11?
Yeah, this would have been there at the end of 2001 into 2002.
Mm-hmm.
It was a short period, and that's why I say loose post-mill, because I think there are certain things about post-millennialism that didn't really, that I didn't quite understand, that didn't take root, because I eventually found out about a Reformed Baptist church in Birmingham that was named Dominion. I was just, you know, searching for churches online and trying to find a fellowship that was teaching this kind of stuff. And I thought, huh, Dominion Baptist, that sounds post-millennial. I got to check these guys out. And I went and visited their church and just instantly fell in love with the people. And so my wife and I plugged into that church there in Birmingham. This would have been towards the end of 2002. And it was in that church that, you know, I shared with the pastor my experiences with ministry and stuff like that. And so he kind of took me up, you know, under his wing and started discipling me. We started going through some works, and I was basically a pastor in training, I guess you could say.
Right.
Actually did a little bit of preaching and Sunday school. But it was during this period is one of the things that I wrestled with was, you know, we say that this passage here is talking about AD 70, and then a couple passages later, we say that this passage here is talking about Jesus coming at the end of history. And I just couldn't for the life of me figure out, you know, what was the hermeneutic behind, you know, determining which coming passages were fulfilled and which ones weren't. And even the preterists, or partial preterists, whatever you want to call them, even they didn't really present things consistently. Like, I remember reading, I think it was Andrew Sandlin, there's a verse in, I think it's 1 Thessalonians, where he says that, you know, anybody that interprets this verse as being fulfilled in the past robs the church of its hope, et cetera, et cetera. And then here he is endorsing a book by Sariah, and in that very same book, Sariah says, well, that same verse was fulfilled in AD 70. So I was like, you know, I don't care what position you come from, that's a problem. I mean, how can you have two guys saying that this, referring to the same verse, and one of them saying it's fulfilled and the other one saying it's not fulfilled?
Right.
And
it's contradiction.
If you say it's fulfilled, you're robbing the church of its. So it just really confused me, like, trying to figure out what was fulfilled and what wasn't. And then during this time, I also read, I was reading Stuart Russell's book that I found out through Sproul, The Parousia. And in that book, he reprints a sermon by John Owen, who interpreted 2 Peter 3 as being fulfilled. And when I read that, my jaw just hit the ground. I was like, well, if that's true, then I just don't know where else to go from here.
So this is what's moving you toward what is commonly called hyperpreterism.
Right. And so in the church that I was in, they, as I began kind of slowly bringing this up and wanting to talk about it, they were pretty hesitant to talk to me about it. In fact, I actually shared with one of the elders in the church that that John Owen had taught this about 2 Peter 3, and he didn't believe me. When I printed the thing out and brought it to him the next Sunday, he just kind of looked at it and looked at me and just walked away. He's like, well, you know, I just didn't even want to talk about it.
Hmm.
And I don't think, I mean, there were preterists in this church, but I guess they had never had anybody take it this far and you know, and asking, you know, where does this end? Where does it stop? And so there was a lot of hesitation there and a lot of fear, I think, just wanting to talk about it. And so naturally that kind of fed into me. And
I can imagine you also had conflicts within some of the systems because, you know, there are what are called classical postmillennialists, and there are also a group called historicist postmillennialists, and then preterist postmillennialists are completely different. Not that they don't have a postmillennial scheme of victory of the church, but how they view things in history and time would differ. Therefore, if you're reading Rushdoony, who's a historicist, if you'd be reading Lorraine Bittner, who was a classic postmillennialist, if you're reading Gentry, you're reading three different concepts of processes to millennial thought. What they had in common was, of course, those four areas of general eschatology that is essential to orthodoxy.
Right.
A visible manifestation of Christ at the end of history, a consummation of history where he's victorious over death and sin or destroyed, resurrection of the dead, and a final judgment. Now, they had those in common, but the processes, just like all-millennialism, differs. And there are different variations of all-millennial thinking on how some things proceed, as you have both with premillennialism, which you can have five or six different perspectives on processes. Processes have never been judged as heretical. What has been judged as heretical is the rejection of those four doctrinal positions that are essential to all end times theories. But I can imagine there is, because I went through it as I studied, moving from dispensationalism to eventually a what I called a modified postmillennialism that was preteristic, because at the time weren't quite using that term. Ken Gentry comes on the scene sometimes later. When we have the seminary open, he's one of the early guys who graduates, writes the book Before Jerusalem Falls. And you hear this term, preterism. It starts floating around. And I'm immediately, as I'm getting his book, I'm reading Russell, Terry, and putting these things together as well. And so it would be easy to see how, if you're reading all those different people, you're getting different ideas. You're getting different concepts in processes. How do we go from A to Z in history to the consummation of all things? And
right.
So the answers aren't necessarily consistent with one another, even if they're in the same camp, as an overview or an umbrella.
Now, Jason, preterism has to do with that which has already been fulfilled, past, right?
Right.
So what would make preterism called hyperpreterism then?
Well, when I, after reading that from Owen, you know, one of the questions I asked was, well, if the heavens and earth has passed away, at least the one Peter's talking about, then I always understood that as a parallel text to at the end of Revelation, you know, that's the same heavens and earth that passes away. And so I basically just taken this leap that the heavens and earth that passed away in Revelation has also passed away and fulfilled. And so we are living in a new heavens and new earth in the full sense. And once you make that jump, you know, that's when you're starting to tinker around with hyperpreterism. Because basically I'd come to the conclusion, like, there's a lot of things that I still didn't quite have worked out in my mind as far as how, you know, how it worked out with my Calvinism and resurrection and things of that. But I don't know. Part of it, I think, was immaturity. And I think some of it, too, was just impatience with my church. And, you know, because this was all happening in a very short time. So,
right.
But I basically just came to the conclusion that, you know, there was one coming of Christ. It happened. It was a single event in history. It was AD 70. And so we are living in this thing called a new heavens, new earth. And as far as I know, from what I can tell, there's nothing after this. This is it. History just goes on forever. And so that hyperpreterism would be defined as basically all prophecy is fulfilled. There's nothing for which that we're looking towards.
After AD 70.
After AD 70.
So how does that move you then towards Samuel Frost? How did you meet Sam? And then eventually, if I'm not mistaken, you were basically an associate pastor with him.
Yeah, I eventually, because I'm teaching and leading a Sunday school in my church, I eventually call up like the lead pastor there teaching and call him up on the phone and say, look, this is where I am. This is what I've embraced. And I even started crying on the phone because I knew it was not going to be pretty. And And so I was done with that church, and they took me off the roll. I guess it was an excommunication, but maybe it wasn't formal or whatever, but that's essentially what happened. And also during this same time period, I was at a gym playing basketball and ended up running through a glass, running through some glass near the door, the lobby entrance, and sliced my knee open.
Whoa.
And so here I was, like within this 2 or 3 week period, I lost my church, lost pretty much most of my friends, and lost my job because I was a foreman for a landscaping company, and I couldn't work. So I had one friend in the church that was kind of, he was going the same route, and we were kind of bouncing ideas off of one another. Well, he decides to get online and search for, full preterist colleges or seminaries or whatever, trying to figure out, where do we go from here? And he's the one that found out about Sam and his church, Christ Covenant. And the thing that immediately kind of attracted me to Sam was that he had the Reformed background and had 2 degrees. And so I knew this guy was studied, and some of the other people that I was seeing online Googling didn't have that, to their resume. And some of the Church of Christ people, I didn't want to have nothing to do with that part of it. So.
Right. It's alien, totally alien to Reformed theology.
Yeah, so I called Sam up one day and just introduced myself and told him that I was interested in what he was doing, want to get some of his material. And I also shared with him that I had lost my church and my job. And about 2 weeks later, I guess he had shared this with his church. They had a small church going on down there in St. Pete, Florida. And one of the men there, Michael Grace, called me back and said, "Well, hey, listen, I've got an appraisal business that's booming right now, and if you want to come down here, and I'd be glad to hire you, and you've got a church that you'd fit into." And so I just did it. I didn't have nowhere to go, or I didn't know what to do, so I ended up going down to Florida and getting plugged into that church and with that job, and that's how I came to know become good friends with Sam.
Now, eventually the church breaks up. Did you leave before that, or is it after the breakup of the church?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of that?
I said eventually the church breaks up.
Oh, yeah.
And did you leave before it broke up, or did you leave after the breakup of the church? Because you moved on to back to Tennessee then. Correct?
Yeah, there's two things going on with this church. Number one, we're full preterists, and full preterists is, it's not systematically developed, and so.
Right.
And number two, we're a new church plant. So, and new church plants just by themselves are difficult, to keep going and start up. And so we just had a lot of infighting. We didn't know what to do. We're like, do we baptize? Do we still baptize? Do we still partake of the Lord's Supper? I mean, he said, do this until I come. So do we stop doing it? And some said no, and some said yes. And then there were some issues about just practically how we live out our lives and what's the mission of the church. And so.
And this is typical of hyper-preterist
right.
dialogue and infighting as well.
Right. And eventually people, a couple would leave and another one would leave and just kind of do their own thing. And so eventually it just got down to a small group of us, and of course Sam had, this really kind of tore him up, because I mean he left a business in Orlando and came over to do this church, and here it is dwindling down to nothing. And so he eventually stepped down, and I actually stepped up and tried to lead things for a little bit, actually did some teaching, but eventually I just called the thing off. I was actually the one that called it off and said,
okay,
look, this is just not going anywhere. We might just stop and regroup, rethink this stuff. And from there, I had, there's a pastor of a Sovereign Grace Ministry church in St. Pete who knew Sam and actually had come to some of our prophecy conferences that we did, debates, Jerry Caesar. And so I called him up one day. I said, look, I want to be plugged into a church, but I'm a full preterist, and so what do you think about this, and is this going to be a problem? And he said, well, we'd love to have you, just don't talk about your full preterism to anybody. I was like, all right, I can handle that. And so we visited their church for about a year,
Okay.
But the great thing about their church is they did take discipleship very seriously, and they were into people's lives, and eventually you just can't hide what you believe, and so eventually it had to come out, and I finally just decided to leave the church, and I didn't want to cause any problems and stuff, so we just left. And
well, let me detract you for just a minute from the path you're on. You also played a very important role in establishing Sovereign Grace Preterism, the website, did you not?
Right.
And that was probably one of the more popular websites for the full preterist movement.
Yeah, when I first started going to Sam's church there, Christ Covenant, they actually had a couple there that was doing the website stuff. Well, they left the church shortly after I got there, and they didn't have anybody to do the website. And I didn't know, or nobody knew how to do anything with websites and stuff. And I was like, well, I can probably figure it out. So that's how I got into doing websites and, or, you know, just a little bit, just tinkering around with it and learning some stuff. And
right.
So I basically took over Christ Covenant Church's site, and then when the church broke up, we turned into Reign of Christ, because we still wanted to, even though we didn't have the church going, we still wanted to offer something up online, people, with just articles and podcasts. So I took over that, and then Sovereign Grace Preterism came up. It's just, you know, with obviously with hyper-preterists, a lot of them are not in churches, and so a lot of them are lonely. A lot of them have been kicked out of their churches, and so a lot of them express just the desire for some type of fellowship. And basically the only thing we could come up with, because there's only like 7 or 6 full preterist churches in the States.
Right.
So there's a big chance that you're not living near one of them if you're a full preterist. So me and a guy came up with this idea of basically creating just a social network where people can join, and they can blog and write and share videos and photos, and kind of like a Facebook platform for full preterists, using the Ning platform. And so after, I ran that for a couple of years, and it's grown to about 400 people, and not all of them full preterists, some of them people looking into it, and some people that are anti and just want to get in there and go after the full preterists. But, you know, the great thing about running that site, when I look back at it, though, is I was able really to gauge really good at where full preterism was, because just about everyone was there hanging out. And so that was one of the things that kind of led to me leaving eventually. But
yeah, you said earlier that you realized that there were things in Reformed theology that you couldn't reconcile with hyper-preterism. There was no way to have a synthesis that would be systematic. It was impossible. So when you begin to realize, I mean, really begin to think through this question, Reformed theology, hyper-preterist incompatibility, what are other things like that led you, and how did you begin to move away from this movement itself?
Well, one of the things I never did as a full preterist, I was never like anti-orthodoxy. I still, 99% of my library was orthodox, and Clark especially. I was becoming a big fan of Clark. And Robert Raymond was something that I picked up systematic. So I'm reading these people all the time. And eventually it just got to the point where I was realizing that some of these, like you said, some of these questions that I had up front, that I just kind of in a wishful thinking thought that I could somehow tweak a little bit and fit within a full preterist framework, I began to realize that it's just not going to work. And more, and then I actually witnessed, especially through the Sovereign Grace Network, that there was a more and more just a ditching or doing away with, you know, just standard Christian thought. Like, I mean, sanctification, for example. Well,
right.
You know, we were all sanctified in AD 70. That's done deal. So we're perfectly sanctified now. And then I'm like, well, what do we do with the presence of sin in our life? And what about when we go to heaven and we die and, you know, are we still going to be sinning? And some are like, well, possibly. You know, just these crazy stuff coming up. Quite like everything was up for grabs. And
the further you had to fight against orthodoxy, the more you have to realize you have to strip orthodoxy out of the system.
Right. And so I noticed that within preterism, you either had people that were openly willing to go down that path, but then you had some people that were quote-unquote conservative that said, well, we disagree with you, but, yeah, we'll still be open to that. You know, that's possible. And see, that I had enough reformed thought in my mind where I was like, no, I can't go there. I can't do that. So even though there's still some immaturity in me, I still at least had something there, a root, that I was able to hang on to that kept me from ditching everything. And and then finally I just I ended up getting laid off in Florida, and my wife and I decided to move up to Tennessee just to get away from the high prices of Florida. I mean, I didn't have a church, I didn't have a job, so there was no point being down there really. So we came to Tennessee, and it was here in Tennessee that I took a trucking job in 2010. I was doing a little bit of over road, and I did that just temporarily to get a local truck job. And so while I'm out in this truck, it's basically just me, my clothes, a little bit of food, and whatever books I could bring. And so I was just constantly reading, like Robert Raymond's Systematic is one of my favorite things to read, go mm-hmm. back through. And again, all these questions just kept coming up is, you know, the systematics of full preterism. How do I work this stuff out? And I just kept hitting these walls and realizing that if I was going to stay true to this framework, everything's fulfilled, that it was going to redefine everything.
Right.
And I just couldn't go there. And so that's, that was middle of 2010, well, beginning of 2010, around there, that I really started questioning some things. And then Sam came along with his infinity thing. You know, if God has an elect group, which I believed in,
mm-hmm.
How in the world do you mesh that with the idea that history goes on forever? Because you've
exactly.
got an infinite number of people. And I thought, and what it was doing, it was driving me back to these questions that I kind of put on the back burner, these systematic questions, and that by Sam forced me to rethink this along with the other things that were going on. And finally, in the end of 2010, I actually posted that a video that my son helped me make. It's a cheesy rap video, but it was that lyric that we just listened to. I put
right.
that on RCM, and somehow, I'm not even sure how it happened, but somehow that led to me saying, you know what, I'm done with full preterism. It just systematically, it doesn't work out. And, you know, we keep harking time texts, but, you know, there's more to the Bible than Matthew 24, verse 34. And it's like, we don't have a clue what we're doing. We're wandering around. And, you know, another thought I had was, full preterists will, they have no problem admitting that full preterism has holes, that it's not fully developed. And yet we still embrace the framework, and we work towards, you know, fixing that. But then I thought, well, why did you leave orthodoxy then? Because when I ask you why you leave orthodoxy, you say because it had holes and you didn't think it was fully developed. Well, all right, so we got two views that, according to you, are underdeveloped and have holes. So why take one or the other? You know, what's motivating you to embrace this other view? And so that's, I just got to the point where I realized that, man, I might have jumped ship just too quick. I was just impatient, and I just wanted to go back into an orthodox framework, like you said, those four pillars, and just it worked from there. And you know, I don't have it all worked out, but it just makes more sense to me to work within what the church has offered for the last 2,000 years, than to embrace this view that's basically just centered around time text and doesn't know anything else about anything else.
And contradictory, to try to bring in orthodoxy to mix it, to blend it, synthesize
right.
it, it just doesn't work. And then to right. defend one section, you have to begin to strip away areas of orthodoxy. God is no longer looking like the God of Scripture. He's being recreated. Redemption has to be recreated. And what you see is really a move, I think, toward the liberal concepts. And, of course, we know from Max King's writings, which was very influential in this whole movement, he being Church of Christ, when he goes and looks at people like Dodd, Bultmann, Brunner, these different liberal and new orthodox guys, Bart, and they don't believe in a resurrection, it's because their soteriology isn't orthodox or evangelical. So for them, it's no big issue. And if you're Church of Christ, being semi-Pelagian, putting you in the same camp, I'm not sure it'd really dawn on you that this is a real track against orthodoxy. But I find that those who have been or come from an orthodox Reformed perspective, or even an evangelical Protestant orthodox perspective, they can't reconcile this. It becomes
right.
an impasse, just what you're talking about. And as hard as they worked at it, Sam Frost had come at different times as he was looking at this and talked to me. And I would keep saying to him, you know, be careful with this stuff, because some of this stuff is really, you know, way overboard. But he would say to me, you know, there's things that I can't deal with election. You're right, because if you have an infinite history that never stops, using that word infinity in that way, the way the Greeks talk about it, then you've got to deal with the question, either there is a set body of elect and they're done, which then brings up the question, how does a person become saved now? Because that's a different form of redemption at that point. You either have two forms of redemption, or you've got to make up something to try to figure out how to resolve that. That means either doing away with the concept of election. Now we're moving to Arminianism. And eventually what we're going to move to is a semi-Pelagianism, something that is like a liberalism or a neo-orthodoxy, but it's no different than Roman Catholicism. And even though Roman Catholicism has orthodox elements left, their theology has become so overloaded with the different teachings that, in essence, they are unorthodox. They're actually apostate in principle. So I can see how that becomes a real problem. In all of this, let me just bring our time to a conclusion. What has it meant for you to return to orthodoxy? How has it affected you and your family?
Well, it affected me a number of ways. And like I said, I still have a lot of questions. You know, there's still some things that I got to work out. You know, one of the things I'm considering is some of the work you've done with preterism, and I acknowledge that within partial preterism there's still some issues, but there are some key things now that I can see that, like, you know, bodily resurrection was something that I clearly was redefining and trying to fit into a time text. And
right.
And then history, you know, the sovereignty of God. If God is sovereign over all, decrees all things, which I have always believed, then you got to ask yourself, well, to what end is he doing it?
Exactly.
You know, what's the purpose? And full preterism, does it have any purpose? So one of the things that it's brought back for me is just really a sense of purpose. You know, my wife and I are back into, we're plugged into a really solid church here in Knoxville.
Excellent.
And just that whole sense of purpose and just being back with the body. I mean, you know, I think it was actually a Catholic guy that told me one time when I was a full preterist that I asked him if he thought we were part of the body. He said, well, you're like a finger that's been chopped off.
You know,
you're laying in the floor bleeding to death. And, of course, I didn't like it at the time when he said that. But now I look back and I'm like, yeah, that's exactly where we're at, just bleeding to death and just losing life out of me. And So just being able to come back to that, coming back to sound doctrine and things just has invigorated me and sparked excitement in life and purpose and realizing that, hey, this is going somewhere. You know, God's at work. And
well, Jason, it's good to hear that you've resolved some of these issues and you've always been a student of the Bible, it sounds like, and you believe God's Word. You're just trying to understand it. And so you're sticking with the best way of understanding it that has been developed over the years by godly people. And while we probably in this life will never know all the answers, and people do have different views trying to sort these things out, it's just really wonderful to hear that you have made the move back to orthodoxy, and we're looking forward to see what you do with your life in the future, because you obviously have gifts and abilities, and we're anxious to follow your career.
Well, thank you. And you know, one of the things I struggle with too when I recanted full preterism, there was a short time where I actually got kind of depressed, because it's just sort of, it really rattles you to think that I was involved in something for 7 years that was heresy and pushing this stuff. And so part of me got really down and depressed about it. But then, you know, that's where I'm anchored into the sovereignty of God, and I can look back and see that, okay, that was not a waste. You know, and there's,
no,
you know,
he has a purpose, and he taught you something.
Yeah, it's like the resurrection, for example, and the purpose of creation. These were things that I once believed in and then left, but now that I've been through that and been on the other side and studied my way back into it, I appreciate now what orthodoxy has been teaching a whole lot better and deeper than I did before. And so, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons God put me through that. So
absolutely.
But yeah.
Well, we're glad. We really are glad for you being back. We're happy that you've associated with us. You're doing a wonderful job on the website, and we're just ecstatic about things that are coming. We're building, we're growing, and we want to see you be a part of that. You've got a lot to offer people, to talk to them, to share with them these kind of things, and opportunities to counsel them in the future about making rash decisions in particular. One of the things that we live in a society of is we want that 15-minute soundbite jump, make decisions, and sometimes we don't sit back and say, do I really want to make this kind of a decision? Do I just want to jump into these things? And then have to be standing in the middle of it, look backwards and go, was this the right choice for me?
Right.
So I think you can really be helpful in influencing and maybe even writing on that very subject in the future and talking about that making rash decisions without really thinking through. And that's a very important thing to learn to do, to think not only of where you'll land, but what are the implications of it? And then what will it cost you to maintain it? Do you have to give up everything you've believed in the past? Does it? No, people don't think in those realms. People don't think about the negative implications as well as the logical conclusions that you would have to go to maintain it. And I think that's something that you have to offer, and Sam Frost has to offer people, to say, look, we went down this road, and when we got down this road so far, and then we ran into the brick wall, and then we begin to say, why are we here? What was the purpose of this? And, of course, God has his reason and purpose. Who knows who you will influence, who you will talk to, the people you will keep from making those wrong decisions. But we're proud of you. I love you. Thank you for the work you do. And I'm looking forward to getting the Last Days of Madness launched and ready to go here. It's been a pleasure to have you on True Believer. Dr. Bill, I'd like to thank you and thank our supporters for being here. Pray for us, please. Tell others about our show. We can be listened to on WhitfieldMedia.com or SermonAudio.com. And until next time, may God bless you and His truth and grace.
Are you considering seminary education? Let Whitfield Theological Seminary provide your educational needs. Whitfield offers master and doctoral degree programs through distance education in ministry, theological studies, biblical counseling, and Christian education. You can complete your studies for the ministry or other church vocations in the privacy of your home in conjunction with your local church. For students who have never been to college, check out the Bachelor Divinity Degree program. Whitfield also offers lay study programs. Go to www.whitfield.edu for additional information. Remember, Whitfield offers classical Reformed theological education. Whitfield Theological Seminary, training a new generation of ministers around the world to disciple the nations in the theology of the Reformation.
Parents, are you looking for a college to send your children to in the near future? Hi, I'm Dr. Randall Talbot, the Executive Vice President and Academic Dean of Whitfield College. Let me share with you why I think you should consider Whitfield College. First, Whitfield brings a Christian college education home to you. We are a distant learning online institution. Second, Whitfield provides a biblical worldview college education. Third, affordability. Because we are a distance learning institution, we can provide a high academic education that you can afford. The average tuition for most online colleges is $300 or more per credit hour. At Whitfield, we charge $80 per credit hour. Fourth, graduates from Whitfield College are highly educated in the majors that we provide. We have graduates that have entered graduate schools all across the country in various different fields. Institutions like the University of Massachusetts of North Dartmouth, Liberty University Law School, and various seminaries. If you would like further information, you may visit the Whitfield College website at whitfieldcollege.org, or you may call the college offices at 863-683-7899. I am looking forward to hearing from you.
A Puritan's Mind is a website dedicated to the gospel of Jesus Christ and the glory of God. Located at www.apuritansmind.com, its purpose is to help those visitors, over 50 million since 1998, to enjoy God and His gracious gospel of redemption through Jesus Christ. It's called A Puritan's Mind because it houses one of the largest selections of writings from the 17th century, covering Christian authors such as Alexander Henderson, Samuel Rutherford, Jeremiah Burroughs, and a whole host of Westminster ministers of the Puritan age. But that's not all. There are sections on the website on church history, historical theology, and doctrinal aspects covering justification, the doctrines of grace, family worship, Christian stewardship, and much, much more. A Puritan's Mind has even reached out over into the Reformed book market with Puritan publications. We have published over a dozen works, including The Covenant of God by Thomas Blake, and one of the most popular introductions to covenant theology called A Simple Overview of Covenant Theology by Dr. Matthew McMahon. All works are available in digital formats as well. You can even acquire an all-in-one special DVD that contains many out-of-print works, sermons, and books from the Puritans and Reformers. Visit us at www.apuritansmind.com for more information, and do all to the glory of God.
You've been listening to Whitfield Radio. Whitfield Radio is a division of Whitfield College and Theological Seminary. Music is provided by our friend, Dr. Phil Kagi, and we encourage you to visit his website at philkagi.com, philkagi.com. This is Dr. Bill Sullivan saying thank you for joining us, and check out our website for the next scheduled show.
Our website is whitfieldmedia.com. WHITEFIELDMEDIA.com. WhitfieldMedia.com.